I invite you now to enter with me the sacred space. Bring with you what is yours, a burdened heart, a joyous song, a wearied spirit, a seeking mind. Bring the gift of yourself to this place of fellowship. It is a good and honorable gift. And now as we light our chalice, and do we have a chalice lighter this morning? I think if not, Michelle, would you be willing to do that? As we light our chalice, I invite you to join in the words of the covenant printed in your order of service. Love is the spirit of this church, and service its law. This is our great covenant, to dwell together in peace, to seek the truth in love, and to help one another.
Thank you.
in memory of all those who have lost their lives to gun violence, in support of all those whose lives have been forever changed by it, and with the commitment to do all we can to prevent senseless deaths from gun violence, let us recite together the litany found on the green sheet in your order of service. More than 90 people die from gun violence in our country every day. An American child is 12 times more likely to die by a gun than are the children who live in all 25 industrialized nations combined. Since John F. Kennedy was assassinated in 1963, more Americans have died by gunfire within our own country than American servicemen and women who were killed in all the wars of the 20th century. We speak for the voiceless of Roseburg, Oregon, Newtown, Connecticut, Columbine, Virginia Tech, Aurora, Colorado, and all the wounded cities and towns throughout this nation torn apart by the ravages of gun violence.
Listen to our voices.
We speak as parents and grandparents, aunts and uncles, brothers and sisters, friends and neighbors of those who have been impacted by gun violence. Some of us have been victims. All of us fear it will touch our lives. There are many forces and special interests that will try to silence us and degrade us, and it will take courage to speak our truth. In the words of Dr. King, we are confronted with the fear urgency of now. In this unfolding conundrum of life and history, there is such a thing as being too late. We must not be too late. Now is the time to end the senseless killing of our boys and girls, our men and women. Now is the time to cease the reckless sale of assault weapons and multiple firing guns, weapons meant only for murder. Now is the time to treat the mentally ill and prevent them from acquiring guns. Now is the time to address the anger and frustration of young men who have no jobs and see no future for themselves. Now is the time to rid our streets of all illegal weapons, to put a stop to the straw purchasing of firearms, and demand that gun dealers adhere to an ethical code of conduct that holds them accountable to the communities in which they do their business. Now is the time. Now is the time to grieve for the loss, to comfort and support those whose lives are forever changed by gun violence, to speak the truth and confront those who misrepresent the facts and spread fear. Now is the time to educate ourselves and others, to advocate and hold our leaders accountable. Now is the time to change the culture of gun violence in this country into a culture of peace. Now is the time. Hear these words from the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. By our silence, by our willingness to compromise principle, by our readiness to allow arms to be purchased at will and fired at whim, by allowing our movie and television screens to teach our children that the hero is the one who masters the art of shooting and the technique of killing, by allowing all these developments, we have created an atmosphere in which violence and hatred have become popular pastimes.
Thank you.
invite you now to be attentive to a story from our Director of Religious Education, Michelle Cote.
Good morning. This was a particularly hard topic to think about. How can I do a message for all ages on something as extreme and as concerning as gun violence? And I thought, what can I do? And I thought, where I can go with this is, what can we do when we are dealt this violence? What can we do as a community? What can we do for each other? And that is reach towards peace. And so this book I shared last year, and I'm sharing it again, it's called Smoky Nights. It's by Eve Bunting. And it's about a little boy that's involved in a riot. And a riot is when people get angry. They get angry at an injustice, typically. Sometimes it's been gun violence that's resulted in people rioting. And they choose people at that time to forget to listen to the voice that says, do the right thing. And they go and they make choices that are not good, that are not legal, that harm things and harm people. And this boy in the story comes up with something that can help people think about what to do in situations when they're angry and when they don't really know each other. Mama and I stand well back from our window looking down. I'm holding Jasmine, my cat. We don't have our lights on, though it's almost dark. People are rioting in the street below. Mama explains about rioting. It can happen when people get angry. They want to smash and they destroy things. They don't care anymore what's right or what's wrong. Below us, people are smashing everything. Windows, cars, streetlights. They look angry, but they look happy too, I whisper. Sometimes after a while, it becomes like a game to some people, Mama says. Two boys are carrying a TV from the appliance store. It's hard for them because the TV is so heavy. Are they stealing it? I ask. Mama nods. When I look around, I see smoke drifting, light as fog. I see the distant flicker of flames. Across the street from us, people are dragging cartons of cereal and sacks of rice from Kim's Market. My mom and I don't go in Mrs. Kim's Market, even though it's close. Mama says it's better if we buy from our own people. Mrs. Kim's cat and my cat fight all the time. And Mrs. Kim yells at Jasmine, my cat, in words I can't understand. Right now, she's yelling at the same kind of words at the people who are stealing her stuff. But they pay no attention. I move behind Mama. Will they come here? There's nothing for them here, Daniel. See? They're finished with our street. They're moving on. We'll sleep together tonight, Mama tells me. She makes me wash my face and brush my teeth. I'm to take off my shoes, but to leave on my clothes. She puts me next to the wall, and I hold Jasmine. I can't sleep, I say. Shh, Mama whispers. Close your eyes. I do. I guess I fall asleep. Because the next thing I know, Mama's shaking me. Quick, Daniel, get up. There's a terrible smell of smoke. Someone's pounding on our apartment door. Fire, fire. I'm suddenly awake. Where's Jasmine? I run to the closet. Sometimes Jasmine sleeps up on a shelf in there. Mama's screaming at me, we can't wait, Jasmine's gone. Put on your shoes, hurry. We rush down the stairs. Other people crowd around us. The smoke starts to make me cough. Outside, the sky is a hazy orange. Flames pounce up the side of our building. Three fire engines scream to a stop, and firefighters jump out, running, pulling their hoses. Is everybody out? One firefighter yells. Far as we know, another says. Did you see a cat? I ask him. She's yellow. Maybe she's still in there. He glances down. Probably not, son. Cats are plenty smart. She'll be long gone. A lady comes up to me. There's a shelter, a building that you can come to, she says. Everyone, follow me. I start to cry because I'm not sure Jasmine is all that smart. What if she's still inside? The lady leading us looks back and sees Mrs. Kim, who is trailing along behind us. Are you all right? She calls. Mrs. Kim nods. We're almost to the shelter, the lady tells her. The shelter is in a church hall. There are cots to sleep on and a table with hot drinks. We see other people from our building. They're talking about who could have done this and what will happen to us. It's a sad, sad night, my neighbor Mr. Jackson says. I ask him about Jasmine. He says he's pretty sure he saw her. She got out, Daniel, he tells me. I hope he's not just trying to make me feel better. Did you see my cat? Mrs. Kim asks. He's orange. He's the color of carrots, I say. And I almost add, and he's fat and mean. But I don't. A girl gives me a mug of hot chocolate, and I wish it had more sugar. When I finish drinking it, Mama says I should lie down. She's always making me lie down. People keep coming. And then suddenly Mama says, look, Daniel, look. And there's the firefighter who was at our building. He is standing in the open door with a smoky night behind him. And I see that he's carrying a cat under each arm. The cats are howling. Jasmine! The blanket's caught on my foot and I'm trilling it. Oh, thank you for finding her. That other cat is mine. Mrs. Kim takes her big, fat, mean old orange cat and holds him close. I'm kissing Jasmine and she smells of smoke. Where was she? I asked the firefighter. The two of them were under the stairs, yowling and screeching, he says. The cats were together? Mrs. Kim asks. The firefighter nods. They were so scared they were holding paws. I grin. No, they weren't. What about our building? Mr. Romero asks. The fire's out. You'll be able to go back in a day or two. A woman puts down a dish of milk. Here, kitty, 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 she calls. Jasmine jumps out of my arms, and Mrs. Kim puts her carrot-colored cat down, too. The cats drink from the same bowl. Milk isn't that good for cats, but I don't say that either. Look at that! Mama's all amazed. I thought those two didn't like each other. Probably because they didn't know each other before, I explain. Now they do. Everyone looks at me, and it's suddenly very quiet. Did I say something wrong? I whisper to Mama. No, Daniel. Mama's tugging at her fingers the way she does when she's nervous. My name is Gina, she tells Mrs. Kim. Perhaps when things settle down, you and your cat will come over and share a dish of milk with us. I think that's pretty funny, but nobody laughs. Mrs. Kim picks up her cat and strokes him. She's staring at the wall. Maybe she's not going to say anything. But then she looks across at Mama. Thank you, she says. We will come. Mama smiles. I reach out and stroke Mrs. Kim's big old orange cat, too. Can you hear him, Mrs. Kim? I ask. He's purring. So I think that the message that I really got from this book, and it's a deep book and it's multi-layered, is really that when we feel the anger of injustice, when we feel the anger of wrong, we need to begin to work together to know the people that are doing the wrong, to think about what's causing that and to see what we can do to make a difference.
Thank you, Michelle. It's our custom here that our children and youth are led to their religious education classes by a lantern that's lit from the flame that we had earlier illuminated in our chalice. And it's an honor to carry the lantern. And do we have a lantern bearer today? I couldn't hear you.
Alex
McNeil is going to carry the lantern for us. Alex, remember that you all follow Alex around, and he goes this way and out the door, and have a good morning in religious education. Each week we provide you with an opportunity for generosity, not only to our church, but to a worthy national, international, or local charitable cause. One half of our non-pledge collection each week is given away, and each month there's a recipient selected. Usually that recipient is nominated by someone in the congregation or a group in the congregation that donates not just their finances, resources to it, but time and talent to it as well. And sometimes, like the one this month, it's an organization that actually helps us, helps people here at First Parish. This month's recipient is the Virginia Thurston Healing Garden, and it helps those who are dealing with cancer, not with the usual Western medical treatment, but with those other kinds of treatments and therapies and support that can make a huge difference in the quality of their life, everything from massage and acupuncture to arts and meditation and more. It's a wonderful place. I've referred people there from our church. We have people who are involved there now receiving treatment. The treatment, of course, costs money, and the funds that we contribute go to an account that helps pay for those expenses for people who cannot afford it. And it's a very important account because they don't want to deny anybody the opportunity for this kind of help. The morning offering will now be gratefully accepted for both the church and the Virginia Thurston Healing Garden. I'd like to read from you from an action of immediate witness passed at our 2014 General Assembly of the Unitarian Universalist Association, affirming our commitment to gun violence prevention. Because Unitarian Universalists affirm the inherent worth and dignity of each person, an unshakable conviction calling us to respect ourselves and others. Because Unitarian Universalists affirm justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, pointing us toward the larger community and a collective responsibility for one another. Because Unitarian Universalists are committed to the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process, And whereas we have witnessed recent mass tragedies at Tennessee Valley Unitarian Universalist Church, Virginia Tech, Aurora, Tucson, Newtown, the Washington Navy Yard, and the University of California at Santa Barbara, and the scourge of individual gun homicides total close to 1,000 each month, and whereas the scourge of gun deaths in the U.S. continue unabated, reaching levels where no one is immune to one of America's greatest public health epidemics, and whereas national polls repeatedly validate the vast majority of citizens, including individual members of the NRA, want sensible legislation requiring expanded background checks and restricting availability of certain firearms and large-capacity ammunition clips to people with documented impairments of judgment and antisocial behavior. And whereas it is regrettably clear that federal and state legislatures have so far found insufficient citizen support to offset the divisive leverage of the NRA and even more virulent opposition forces to such legislation, and therefore be it resolved that the 2014 General Assembly endorse renewing the focus and call for congregational commitment to work for gun violence prevention initiatives, be it further resolved that the General Assembly encourage member congregations to take action, such as urging the Center for Disease Control to study and publish data on gun violence, working for gun safety, background checks, and a ban on assault weapons at a national, state, and municipal level, reaching out to partner with interfaith groups and community activists, speaking with police and local public health professionals, elected officials, and candidates for office, and speaking out in local forums, town meetings, and media. In the past few weeks, we've turned on our televisions and seen not once, not twice, but three times the news of a young man who has shot and killed innocent students on a college campus. 9 dead at a community college in Oregon. 4 shot and 1 killed at Northern Arizona University. 1 killed and another seriously injured at Texas Southern University. The same state that just months ago passed a law that will soon go into effect allowing the carrying of concealed guns on college campuses. And if you watched the news this morning, there was another shooting in Florida. This story of young men with guns committing horrible, senseless acts of mass violence is a story, as Alex alluded to in his beautiful song, that is one that we've almost become used to. One of the national news commentators has calculated that we experience a major shooting incident about every 2 months in our country. And it's not just at colleges, as you well know. It's at elementary schools and high schools. Innocent children killed in senseless gun violence at the very place where we think they are safe, where they go to learn and become good adults. But for no reason personal to them, their lives are cut off by these horrible acts of gun violence. And of course, it's not just children. It's adults in movie theaters, as we know, or in churches, as we know, or other places. These are the sensational cases, the ones that attract the media coverage, the ones so outrageous that it seems impossible that they do not bring new law and new procedures to sensibly regulate the ownership and availability of guns. But in truth, the schools and other sensational shootings are just a drop in the bucket when we look at the number of people killed in this country by gun violence. Find all different statistics, but consensus of about 90 a day, more than 30,000 a year, more than all those killed in war, far more than those killed in other developing countries similar to ours. In fact, one study shows that Americans are 20 times more likely to die of gun violence than citizens of a certain group of similar countries. In addition to those killed, those injured by gun violence total 270 a day, more than 100,000 a year. We have to ask ourselves the question, when will enough be enough? When will we as a nation do something about this problem? And I believe, and I hope you believe, the time is now. You know, when I and other clergy have chosen to address the issue of guns, some have told us we are straying too much into politics. But I couldn't disagree more. The issues presented by the epidemic of gun violence in our nation are theological and moral questions of the deepest magnitude. The scriptures of our Judeo-Christian and Islamic heritage began with us addressing the issue of violence committed by one human being against another. It's, of course, the story where Cain kills his brother Abel. In that story, God asks Cain, "What have you done to your brother?" It's the same question that we ask ourselves collectively this morning. Those words of that beautiful South African song that the choir sang for us this morning, Senzenina, what does it mean? It means, what have we done? The words we shared of Dr. King tell us that we collectively bear responsibility for gun violence in our society. Gun violence raises at least two profoundly theological issues, that of evil and that of the suffering of the innocent. You know, there was a time when all evil was viewed as coming from some spell from a devil or a demon. But in the modern world, we understand evil as something that humans initiate. And that being the case, each of us has power to exercise, to stand with evil, acquiesce to falsehood, or to bring the light of truth and justice to work for the good. I believe that evil is the product of the breakdown of right relationships between people. It's why I believe that real community, which makes real our first principle, the affirmation of the inherent worth and dignity of every person, is such a critical part of religion. When we look at those angry young white men who have become the mass killers, and that's what most of them are, and the angry young black men who use guns to shoot each other on the street in gangs, we see individuals whose worth and dignity have not been affirmed. We see frustration with a society that does not allow them to get ahead. We see individuals who have fallen out of the beloved community become isolated and thereby susceptible to the preaching of hate. Looking at the issue from the standpoint of the victims also presents a profoundly religious question. The problem of the suffering of the innocent and how we respond to it is a paramount theological issue. Our faith, and in fact most faiths, teach us that human suffering demands a response from us all. Yes, of course, there is the pastoral response to one individual's suffering, and some people think that that's all religion should do. But if we are to meaningfully live our faith, we have to respond to suffering at more than the level of the individual. We have to address it at the level of a society, and that, of course, does put us in the arena where politics are played. But I'm not here to play politics. I'm not interested in special interests that make lots of money on guns. I'm here to talk justice and compassion, to talk how we affirm and protect life, how we prevent human suffering, how we reconnect with those who are isolated from the love of community, whether it's due to mental illness or the lack of opportunity, and how we chip away, yes, just chip away, at the culture of guns and violence and work to establish a culture of mutual respect and peace. With the powerful pro-gun interests seemingly owning our government and pumping us full of misinformation, it seems like this is a futile cause. But the vast majority of Americans want at least some reasonable gun control measures. So there must be a way to have the will of the people acted on. I'm no Pollyanna. I know that money talks, and believe that until we have meaningful campaign finance reform in this country, on many issues, the will of the public will be thwarted. But still, I believe enough individuals armed with the facts so that they can see through the lies of the pro-gun lobby can force at least some change that will lessen gun violence in our country. You hear the pro-gun people in every debate say, guns don't kill, people kill. Well, okay. We must acknowledge that there is, in fact, a people problem. So let's address that first. Let's improve our mental health system. Make mental health care available to those who need it. Let's require mental health providers to inform authorities and release them from the privilege that they have to observe if they see alarming signs of potential violence in an individual. Let's have universal background checks so criminals and the mentally ill and those who have a history of domestic violence can't buy guns. Yes, let's do something to address the people that kill. You know, the state of Missouri had done that. They had a gun permit law that required extensive background checks. But with pressure from the gun lobby, they repealed that law in 2007. And you know what happened? Murders increased by 16%. The weakness in firearm laws relating to background checks does lead to more deaths by gun violence. It's fact. Addressing mental illness is important, but we have to be careful. Just doing that alone will not solve gun violence problems in our country. And in truth, people with mental illness are not more prone to violence than the general population. And in fact, people living with mental illness are more likely to be the victims of violent crimes than they are the perpetrators. Let's not forget that as we go through this discussion. There's much more to this problem than just the mentally ill. You see, looking at how we engage with people who become the killers, how we intervene, how we prevent them from having guns is important, but it's not enough. The simple availability of guns does increase the killing. And this is particularly true in cases of suicide, accidental death, and domestic violence. Compared with other Western countries, combined with other Asian countries, all of these countries which restrict gun ownership, our murder rate is 7 times higher, our suicide rate 6 times higher, and our accidental death rate from guns 5 times higher. And an amazing statistic one researcher offers, 80% of all firearms deaths in the developed world happen in the United States. The fact is simple. The availability of guns is directly related to the number of deaths. Case closed. And then we hear that restricting gun ownership does nothing to keep guns out of the hands of criminals and leaves the innocent public unable to protect themselves. From my experience, I believe that both parts of that equation have serious problems. First, many criminals do not use guns to commit crimes because they know if they're caught, the penalty is much stiffer. I experienced that as a DA. And in fact, there's been a study done that asked criminal inmates who did not use guns in the commission of their crimes why they did not. 79% said it was because if they were caught, they'd get a stiffer sentence. And 59% said because it was illegal. But still, and in countries like Japan and Great Britain, where handgun ownership is basically outlawed, gun crimes are a small fraction of what they are in the U.S. And in fact, in about 60% of the cases that are initially charged as gun crimes, it turns out it was a toy gun because they couldn't get a real gun. And the idea that arming the general public will keep them safe is very wrong. I saw it many times where people had their guns taken away and may have even been shot with their own. I remember in the DA's office someone coming in who thought I would be very happy to hear what they said. They said, oh, I'm doing a lot of traveling these days and what's going on in the world, I'm going to buy my wife a gun and keep it by her so she can keep it by her bed in her nightstand. Really, I said. Do you know what's likely to happen if someone should break into the home and she, half asleep and untrained in the use of the gun, tries to use it? Most likely it'll be taken away from her and she might well get shot with her own gun. Last of all, we hear, no matter what we may want for gun control laws, we can't do anything because the Second Amendment's rights to bear firearms is an absolute right. We hear that all the time. And that statement is categorically false. Just in the past few years, in an opinion written by the most conservative justice on our Supreme Court, reasonable gun laws were held constitutional. If we can prevent a felon from having guns, as the court did, then there's no constitutional ban on enforcing that with universal background checks. How else would you do it? If we can ban sawed-off shotguns, as the court did, then a ban on automatic weapons and large-capacity magazines should present no constitutional problems as well. You know, just this week, you may have seen on the news, a store in Milwaukee, gun store, was found responsible for selling a gun to a legal purchaser who was purchasing it for someone else who was with him in the store. That person, who was not qualified to buy a gun, called it a straw purchase. And that person who got the gun used it to shoot two police officers. The judgment was for $6 million. That was an earth-shattering decision. And although personally I'd like to see no shops that sell guns, especially handguns, we need to hold those who sell guns to the highest of ethical and legal standards and hold them responsible when they're not, just like this jury did in Milwaukee. Look, I know in this country, especially rural areas, there are hunters and ranchers who may need guns. I don't want to take their guns away. But you don't need a high-capacity magazine or an automatic weapon or a concealed handgun to go hunting or to protect your cattle. As a people of faith, we need to raise our voices in response to the suffering of the innocent. We need to raise our voices for the mentally ill that are not receiving treatment. We need to face the facts that we bear some responsibility for the angry young men who find no jobs and no community to help them. We need to confront our elected officials and demand universal background checks and restriction on the sale of weapons that have no place in the hands of private individuals. We need to force action on these issues. You know, here in the suburbs, sometimes it can seem like the problem is not our problem. But for many right here, gun violence has hit close to home. Some of us have friends and relatives who've been victims or who have perhaps taken their own lives when a gun was available at a time when they were mentally distraught. Some of us have lost family members to gun accidents. Some of us have been in the crossfire of youth with guns. You know, at our urban ministry in Roxbury, we have buried from First Church many Roxbury kids who were innocent victims of gun violence. And a few years ago, one of our staff was shot just while putting gas in a car. You just don't know whose life gun violence has touched or will touch. This country, unlike others similar to us, has far, far more gun violence. I don't pretend to have all the answers, but I know that each of us has to take this issue into our hearts. We have to live a faith that puts the lives of people before the desires of people to own weapons. We have to stand with truth and not falsehood. We have to look evil in the face and know it's a human problem that we can help address. We cannot abandon the suffering of the innocent. I think enough is enough. I think now is the time. We have to be part of building a different kind of country, one of love and not hate, of peace and not violence. Please take these words into your heart and do whatever you can.